Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Samsara, a documentary filmed in 25 countries, takes you to sacred grounds, disaster zones, and natural wonders. It's now available on demand. And from Academy Award nominee Roman Coppola, Charles Swan stars Charlie Sheen, Bill Murray, and Patricia Arquette, and is available on demand before it hits theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
This podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/SVU.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And today we're going to explore the subdued, emotionally generous, and naturalistic portrait of working-class Texas life that is William Friedkin's Killer Joe.
Later we'll bring you Cue Shots, our look at some of the current offerings on various streaming and VOD sites, all centered around a common theme. Inspired by Killer Joe, we thought we'd take a look at some other movies in which characters perform sex acts on food. But though there are more films out there featuring that than you might think, our attempt at taking on that topic ended up just being a half hour of us giggling uncomfortably and coming up with terrible euphemisms. So instead, we're going to take a look at some movies set in Texas.
But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight one title that's new on VOD and give you a rundown of a few other notable films new on demand on cable. Matt, what's our first pick this week?
Well, speaking of movies about sexual assault that feature fast food, Our first pick is a very provocative movie entitled Compliance. It's directed by Craig Zobel, and it is a real-life story, or at least a story based on a real-life case of this assault that took place at a fast food restaurant, and it stars a really nice cast, including Ann Dowd, who did not get nominated for an Academy Award, but I think should have been, and actually, it's kind of sad. She actually put her own money, thousands of dollars, into like her own campaign, and it's a shame she didn't get nominated. She's really fantastic as the manager of this fast food restaurant, and really one of the main perpetrators, or at least the enablers, of this horrific act that took place in this fast food restaurant. Dreema Walker from, what's the show she's on?
Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23.
Thank you. She's one of the stars of that show. She is the main victim of the crime in this case. She is accused of basically stealing from one of the customers in this fast food restaurant by an unseen person on the phone. He calls the fast food restaurant, claims to be a police officer, and he asks Ann Dowd's character to help in his investigation until he can get there.
This is Officer Daniels
with the police department.
I have a woman here saying
one of your employees took money out of her purse. You have a young lady who works at the register, about 19 years old, blonde.
Becky, come with me.
I swear, I didn't take anything. I don't know what's going on here. I'm just trying to do my job.
Calm down for me, okay?
You don't realize what kind of trouble you're in. We need to find the money, but I'll need your help till I can get down there. We really have two choices here.
He's saying he will have to take you to jail.
Or what we could do is have you strip search her right now.
I could strip search you here.
No. No.
When you read what happened in the real case, it's kind of horrifying how close to the real event Craig Zobel stayed. And this movie, which premiered last year at the Sundance Film Festival, has been one of the most kind of talked about, divisive movies. I know I really liked it. Did you enjoy it, Allison?
I did.
Maybe enjoy isn't
the right
word.
Enjoy is a tough word to use with it, but it definitely
found it fascinating and provocative.
Yes,
and
very much so.
Upsetting in all the right ways, you know.
Yes.
But people walked out of the first screening. Supposedly the first Q&A at Sundance was really heated with people, making accusations and pointing fingers and storming out and how could you do this and all that sort of thing. So it is an upsetting movie. It's a very provocative movie. It's a button-pushing movie, deliberately so. So you should know that going in. But it is a very, very interesting movie. And I think it's more than just the shock value. You know, I think Craig Zobel is a really talented up-and-coming director. He made a very interesting movie from a few years ago called The Great World of Sound, which had some similarities in terms of the content, and one actor in common, this great actor, Pat Healy, who's in this film and was in that film. And I think he has a really good skill, not only at directing actors, but like casting actors. And there's a lot of great little parts in this fast food restaurant. And I think one of the reasons the movie works is everyone in that restaurant, they seem like real people. And we don't get to see a lot of them, like a lot of time. But just they make these indelible impressions. The guy who works at the cash register and is kind of this like dopey kind of teen jock character, but has this sort of core humanity to him. And the manager especially just seems all too chillingly real, I think. And a lot of that, I think, credit belongs to Craig Zobel. So that's Compliance. It's now playing on VOD. And before we move on to the rest of our on-demand picks this episode, Allison, we actually have something to announce.
Something exciting.
Something very exciting that actually connects in a very direct way to Compliance. And that is what we are doing, our very first ever live podcast, Film Spotting SVU Live! Exclamation point. Mark your calendars if you're in the New York area. It's going to be Saturday, February 23rd at Videology in Williamsburg. It's a cool video store and screening space. We're going to have a lot of stuff going on. We're going to have a podcast. We're going to try to do like a full podcast. We're going to do a screening of Compliance. And then we're going to have a Q&A with director Craig Zobel. He will not be in attendance. He'll be on Skype. We'll be talking to him via Skype. I hope no one will storm out. But they'll
oh,
be able,
I hope someone
you
will
hope
storm
people
out.
Storm out?
Yes.
Well, if you don't storm out, you'll be able to ask Craig Zobel some questions over Skype. We're thinking of having some contests, some prizes. I'm going to spring this on you, Allison. It's actually the day before the Oscars.
Ooh.
So maybe we can do one of our ill-advised Oscar contests.
I think we should do that.
Where we try to predict the winners.
We'll have to come up with some stakes, though.
Yeah, and the loser has to do something horrible. A few years ago, we did one of these ill-advised Oscar contests, and I had to drink an entire bowl of cheese dip, of queso dip, and almost died.
Yeah, so, I really enjoyed watching that.
And I really did not enjoy doing it, which is why I will win this year. But so, yes, that's going to be Saturday, February 23rd. We'll have more details about tickets and like the exact time on our next episode. But if you are in the New York area, we would love to see you. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then it's going to be very challenging. We'll do the fun stuff first. We'll have the podcast before Compliance because it is a kind of a freaky, intense movie. It'd be weird to be like, yes, yucking it up after we watch it. So we'll have some fun first, then we'll watch the movie, then we will talk to Craig Zobel. And that's Saturday, February 23rd at Videology in Williamsburg. If you want more info, it's not up there yet, but their website is videology.info. So we hope to see you there. Allison, what's our other VOD picks this week?
Two more quick picks for you. They're both Sundance 2012 titles, since the next iteration of the festival is starting this week, I believe. So the first is Dutropia, which is a documentary from Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady, who are documentary team, probably best known for Jesus Camp. This is a documentary about the city of Detroit, a city that, you know, has gone through tough times, many tough times recently, and has become, as they put it, emblematic of the collapse of the U.S. manufacturing base. But it's this really beautifully made and kind of poetically made look at the city, which is, you know, this kind of grand, remnant of what used to be in terms of a city that no longer has the industry that it used to. So beautifully made, but not, you know, kind of sad as well. It's on VOD on Tuesday, January 15th. The other film is a scripted film. It is The End of Love, which is a drama directed by and starring Mark Webber, who's an actor you may remember from Storytelling or Scott Pilgrim versus the World. He's been acting for a long time. This is a drama about he plays a young father who is looking after his infant son, his toddler son, following the death of the boy's mother. And this is how personal this is. Weber's own son plays the son in the movie. So definitely a very intimate and close look at the relationship between a young father and a son. That is on demand ahead of its premiere in theaters on Monday, January 21st.
Allison, we're delighted to have Audible back as a sponsor of SVU this week. And Audible is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. And for our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. Allison, do you have a recommendation? One possible free title people might want to check out this week?
Well, you know, since we're talking about a William Friedkin movie, who, by the way, has a memoir coming out in April called The Friedkin Connection.
Ooh.
I know.
That's going to be good.
I thought that we'd point out that the book that served as source material for what's arguably his best known film, The Exorcist, is on Audible. It is The Exorcist 40th Anniversary Edition, and it's read by William Peter Blatty, who is the author of what was originally a 1971 novel. What's kind of interesting about this 40th anniversary edition is that he's done basically a director's cut. He's had done some revisions, added a little new material. As he explained, the first time around, he couldn't afford to do a second draft of the novel, he said, in like introducing it. So this is his, like, he went back and did revisions, having had 4 decades to think about it. He added, I think, like a small new character, you know, kind of cleaned it up a bit. So
sounds like he's a big fan of George Lucas,
right?
Potentially.
I know there's a little bit of that there, but hopefully it's all improvement. He says that this is the version I would like to be remembered for. So if you've always thought that The Exorcist is a frightening movie, and I mean, if you don't, then who are you? Because it's a terrifying movie. Then this might be an interesting way to look at the novel. It's especially when it's read by the author, who's apparently does a particularly good job of reading it. So that is The Exorcist 40th Anniversary Edition.
Okay, so if you would like The Exorcist 40th Anniversary Edition or another free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/SVU. That's audiblepodcast.com/SVU. All right, let's get into cue shots. And when you guys decided on Killer Joe as our listener's choice, Allison and I were debating what options. We actually, speaking of William Friedkin, we kind of wanted to do a Friedkin podcast, and I think that would have been interesting. Not enough movies available for streaming, especially. So we decided to scuttle that for the time being. And then we were talking about, you know, crime movies. We were talking about Southern movies. And I thought Southern movies could be interesting, but maybe a little too broad. So I was like, well, what about Texas movies? Because that seemed more specific. And that's what we decided on. And then I did the research, and I was like, actually, that's almost too broad, too, because there are so many movies and different kinds of movies about different parts of Texas. You know, it's such a big state and has so many different kind of points of view about it that perhaps it was an ill-advised choice anyway, but we got some great movies out of it, I suppose. That's the good part. So I don't know if there's anything else we want to say in a general sense, or should we just dive right in?
There was one thing I wanted to mention. I did, it, unfortunately not on demand, but one of the kind of more surprising Texas movies I ever saw, incidentally, I think, at South by Southwest, was The Whole Shooting Match by Eagle Pinnell, who was an indie, like, I think Austin area mostly, filmmaker.
Okay.
Who they restored that film, and it's really worth looking for. I think it's only on, it's on DVD, but in terms of just being an indie film, and I think it was made in the 70s, is really interesting. Like, it's warm, funny, and really not like anything else I'd seen, especially from that era in Texas. So it's pretty neat. Worth a look.
Okay. I would just want to mention, I don't think, do you have any Westerns on your list, Allison?
I have one.
You have one. Okay. Because
yeah.
I don't have any Westerns. And I have to admit, I feel kind of bad about that, just because that's one of the things, like when you say, okay, well, Texas on screen, what do you think of? I mean, one of the things that instantly comes to mind is a Western. You know, there's so many great Westerns set in Texas. And I just want to mention very briefly, because I know you're not going to mention these. If you've ever heard of Roy Rogers, the not just for fast food, but before he was a fast food icon, he was a film icon and a TV icon and a singing cowboy. There are a ton of Roy Rogers movies available on Netflix, including a lot with the word Texas in the title, including Rainbow Over Texas, Eyes of Texas, Song of Texas, Cowboys from Texas, and The Yellow Rose of Texas. So I actually watched a little bit of some of them, and they're actually pretty fun. I mean, if you want a singing cowboy movie, you're not going to do much better than a Roy Rogers. So I actually would recommend maybe just doing a quick search for Roy Rogers. You're going to see a lot of movies about Texas. You're going to see a lot of movies that don't have Texas in the title necessarily, but that might be something to take a look at, because it's not somebody that gets a lot of talk and conversation. And I have a feeling most people listening will have never seen a Roy Rogers movie. So maybe something to check out. Want to start, Allison? What's your first Texas movie?
My first Texas movie, and I feel like my picks kind of either went to like big and epic Texas movies or Those are the two poles, right? And then you have like very kind of like grimy, like life is hard in Texas movies.
Right.
And this is probably on the life is hard in Texas movies.
Okay.
It's Into the Abyss, directed by Werner Herzog, 2011 film, documentary. And one I thought was really terrific. It's as an all topic, Herzog is always able to discover and seemingly without forcing it, you know, affirmations of his particular worldview. And he manages to do that in what's a tale of a triple homicide that happened in Conroe, Texas, and the two young men who were convicted of it, one of whom at the start of the film is on death row, waiting to be executed, and the other is has gotten, I think, like life, basically. The crime's horrible, but they were teenagers, and they basically went to steal a car belonging to the mother of a friend, and ended up killing that friend, killing the mother, and then I forget who else they killed, but like it was this completely unnecessary, terrible thing. In exploring this crime and kind of exploring the town, Herzog just finds these incredible interviews that reveal this town as a place that's just like in which like imprisonment and violence and like untimely death are just part of the fabric of the life there somehow. I think there's so many memorable moments. Like there's one point where the father of one of the boys who has been in jail most of his life, they have Christmas dinner together behind bars, and they're like, the guy is kind of like, you know, isn't this great, Dad? And the father is like, he says, I think I'm trash and I wish I could serve his time for him. There are a lot of moments like that that are just kind of beautiful and heartbreaking, but also, you know, it's a story of two people having Christmas dinner in prison. And maybe the best interview is one that is very incidentally related to the film. It's a friend who has not that much to do with the main story and who is supposed to talk about, you know, how he knew one of the guys, and just gives like this a spiel of amazing stories, including about how he didn't learn to read until he was an adult, about how he got stabbed in the chest with a screwdriver and then went to work right afterwards. It's kind of amazing.
So she let him in the house to use the telephone, and while he was doing that, Michael Perry stepped out of the laundry room. That's when he shot her. This was the vehicle that Michael Perry and Jason Burkett was after. Three people died for this car.
I think that it feels both like a side of small town, kind of like or smallish town Texas, that you don't get to, that's very rarely seen on any screen, but also it's a very Herzog movie at the same time, and that it's done so well. You know, there is this kind of great depth to it in terms of it, in what could have been basically a true crime story. That's Into the Abyss. It's available streaming on Netflix.
All right. Well, I'm going to pair that with another documentary. I guess when you think Texas on screen, one of the things you think of is the Texas justice system and really the death penalty. You know,
yeah.
The popularity, I guess, for lack of a better word, of the death penalty, which is very much the subject of my first pick, the 1988 documentary The Thin Blue Line, directed by Errol Morris, also available on Netflix. And what is interesting now about this movie, which is now several decades old, is, you know, it's a famous case of this man who's wrongfully imprisoned for this crime he did not commit, you know, sentenced to die, basically, and he was on death row and all that sort of thing. Is the movie itself became a huge, you know, topic, and the guy was eventually released. He was, you know, the movie helped prove his innocence. So the movie is undeniably important, but I guess you look at it and go, well, he's been released. Actually, he passed away a few years ago, you know, of an illness. So you go, well, is it still worth watching now? And I think it is, because, one, it's just this unbelievable story. I mean, just as a story, as a yarn, it's just unbelievably watchable. But then it's also just, I think, a really important look at confirmation bias. You know, this idea that this guy just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, that he bumped into this kid who is the actual, in all likelihood, although he was never actually convicted of the crime, he was the guy who did this crime, but he was a 16-year-old kid, and the people who were prosecuting, investigating, looked at the 16-year-old and looked at the 28-year-old, and one of the theories put forward in the movie by one of the defense lawyers is that basically they said, well, we can't get the death penalty on a 16-year-old kid, but we can get the death penalty on a 28-year-old. so let's prosecute the 28-year-old. And there are these unbelievable, Freudian slips that these cops are saying, things that they're saying in this movie that your jaw just drops, you know, like things like he almost overacted his innocence, you know, which is absurd because the guy was innocent. He wasn't acting innocent. He was innocent. But they had made their minds up. This guy was guilty. So he must be acting innocent, you know. Or there's another incredible line of dialogue where he says, one of the other cops says, "We didn't want him to tell us something he thought. We wanted him to tell us what we knew."
Being nosy, I just stared. I was leaving the plush pub one night, driving a 1977 Cadillac, heading west on Hampton. I noticed an officer had two individuals pulled over to the curb in a blue some type of vehicle. It was a blue Ford. It was a blue something.
I think even though, you know, in a certain sense, the movie did its job many years ago, I think it's a really incredible documentary still and definitely worth watching. And as a Texas movie, I think it's a good one for that, you know, for the reasons we've discussed. There's also a very kind of potent line from Randall Adams, the guy who was, you know, wrongfully convicted of the crime. He says, "If there ever was a hell on earth, it's Dallas County." So with respect and apologies to the people of Dallas, I think it fits very nicely in this topic. So that's The Thin Blue Line, and it is available on Netflix.
Yeah, the people of Dallas do not necessarily get a great representation in Killer Joe either, at least in the small group of people who end up on screen.
That's true.
So apologies again.
Yeah, maybe we blanket apologies.
On behalf of the world of film,
yeah,
apparently. So my next pick is a children's film, and I think a really uncommonly enjoyable one. It is Holes, the 2003 film directed by Andrew Davis, who's better known for these action films like The Fugitive and Under Siege. It's rentable on Amazon, YouTube, and iTunes, based on the book by Lewis Sacker, who's a well-known young adult children's author. And it stars Shia LaBeouf before Michael Bay and Steven Spielberg attempted to kind of shove him down our throats as the next big blockbuster star. He plays Stanley Yelnats IV, a teenage boy whose family has supposedly been cursed for over 100 years. And because of this, maybe, he's falsely accused of stealing a pair of sneakers that was donated by a famous baseball player to a charity. And he gets sent off to a juvenile detention camp out in the middle of a dried up lake in Texas. And it's one run by Sigourney Weaver and John Voight and Tim Blake Nelson. It's definitely a trio of troublemakers and can't be trusted. And I think beyond just the really striking key visual of this, which is you have this like giant dried out kind of desert area, and what the boys are made to do is dig holes every day. They get sent out and they dig holes, and it's presented as being like good for their character, right? This is they're gonna learn something, they're being punished, but like it's work, it's good for the soul. There's a real sense of place, like this kind of, it's like a heightened story, but there's a real sense of basically all of these layers of history that you come to understand have to do with like why they're digging holes, who Sigourney Weaver's character is. And it brings in, I think, a kind of great side story about this like outlaw bandit, about interracial romance, and about basically like being a good person. And I think it manages to weave them all together in a way that's really kind of lovely and very satisfying.
My name is Stanley Yelnats. All my life, I seem to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. My grandpa says it's because of this 150-year-old curse.
There's no curse on this family.
There is on the men in this family.
It's all because of your no-good, dirty, rotten, pig-stealing great-great-grandfather.
Welcome to Camp Green Lake.
Where's the lake?
This is Stanley.
Everyone in my family names their son Stanley because it's Yelnats backwards.
Well, that's interesting.
It's a really enjoyable movie. I don't think you have to be a kid to enjoy it. I think it's pretty well made. That is Holes. It's available for rent on Amazon, YouTube, and iTunes.
All right. That's a good pick. My next movie does not pair quite so elegantly as our last two. And this is not a kid's movie. This is a film not for kids. But I don't exactly think it's quite so outrageous either. It is a movie I'd never seen before we recorded this podcast, but doing the research, trying to find some new movies that I haven't seen before that might be worth watching. I watched this one and I really enjoyed it. It's called The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas from 1982, directed by Colin Higgins. It is available on Netflix Instant. And, you know, I wasn't sure going into it. I was just kind of very curious. But after watching it, I do think it is kind of a great Texas movie. You know, it kind of gets at a lot of the contradictions of the place, at least as I see them as an outsider. You know, that sort of very law and order side of Texas that we already talked about with those documentaries. And also kind of that, you know, rugged individualism, kind of Western spirit, we were once our own country kind of thing, where it's like the law and order on the one side, the wanting to follow the law and uphold the law, and on the other side, that whole sort of like, leave me alone, libertarian, I'm going to let my own moral compass dictate what I do sort of thing. It is about a whorehouse, the Chicken Ranch, that has existed basically for decades in this little part of Texas, and this consumer advocate reporter on television. And apparently this is all based on a true story, which I did not know before I looked this up also. This consumer advocate reporter who sees himself as this great moral voice in the community, he decides it takes it on himself to shut the Chicken Ranch down. That's Melvin P. Thorpe, played by Dom DeLuise, in a really wonderful comedic performance. One of the things I did like about this movie was the way that his character, you know, without talking about it too much, they really sell him as, you know, these guys who go on television as, you know, the voice of moral authority, you know, and wagging their finger at what is wrong in our society. And then behind closed doors, these are inevitably the people that are the most screwed up and the most weird, or at least just the biggest liars. And so when we first meet this character, he's getting dressed for a TV appearance, which includes, you know, putting on like a girdle or something to kind of hide some of his Dom DeLuise-ness, and then shoving like a ball of socks down his pants.
Which show did you like best, Ed? I think the one about the nuts in the chocolate bar.
It's one of my favorites. 60 means 60, like the Bible says. So if it says 60 nuts on the wrapper, I want to see 60 nuts inside. And I'm talking full nuts. I'm not talking a half nut or nut bits or nut chips. I'm talking a full nut. I can see that.
He's talking about a false advertising scam that he shut down while he's shoving a ball of socks down his crotch, which I thought was quite a succinct little a metaphor for this character. Has some nice songs, maybe not the most memorable songs of all time. It does have Dolly Parton singing I Will Always Love You to Burt Reynolds, which is kind of good. And actually, Burt and Dolly have some lovely scenes together. And I like the moral of it. You know, maybe it's too much of my – maybe it's my own confirmation bias at work here. But just this idea that this place wasn't hurting anybody. It was, you know, it was a brothel. But these people paid their taxes. They were popular in the community. They were upstanding citizens. They were just – it was just a place to where hooker – you could go see a hooker. And there wasn't anything dirty about it, as they say. And I just kind of like that. And I like the message of the movie, which feels almost more appropriate now or more timely now than it maybe even did back in 1982. So that's The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. If I didn't mention it explicitly, it is a musical. It was a charming movie overall. I actually really enjoyed it. The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, it is available on Netflix Instant.
Okay, my last pick, since we had to get a Western in here.
We really did.
Yeah. So I thought I would pick... It's an easy pick. It's one of the greatest Westerns ever made. It's The Searchers, 1956, directed by John Ford, streaming on Amazon Instant Video. Now, I was looking up, there was a little while ago, they did a list of, there was a discussion of the 10 greatest Texas
movies.
Films.
Yeah. I saw this online. I read it too.
Yeah, including our friend Tim League of the Alamo Drafthouse was one of the participants.
Yes.
And I thought this was interesting. John Bloom, who may be better known under the name he performs, Joe Bob Briggs, who is from Dallas, explained this about why The Searchers was a great Texas movie.
Okay.
He said, it's the greatest movie about Texas stubbornness. There's no reason for that family to stay there waiting for the next Indian attack. And the other thing is, why would you search? John Wayne knows that by the time he finds his girl, she will have become a Comanche. So why would you spend 8 years searching? That's another Texas trick. Men never quit, even when there's no longer any point. And which I thought was interesting.
Well said.
And it does seem like there is a particular, I mean, you know, John Wayne's character, Ethan Edwards, in this is such an amazing, complicated character. And I think that he does maybe represent this particular, I don't know if it's necessarily unique to Texas, but like this particular kind of frontier mentality. You know, he is racist. He's got very like these ideas about, you know, he, when he finally does track down Debbie, kind of one of the famous scenes, he's ready to kill her for right. being, for living among the Comanche.
For going native, so to speak.
For going native, yeah. And yet he knows all of the Comanche culture, you know, like he,
right.
he, like moves very easily in this very multicultural world, mm-hmm. you know, between the kind of like the cantina and like all of this, like his, despite his kind of idealizing this, his brother's family and civilization in this very white sense, this white frontier sense, like his world is not that, you know, that is not the world he comes from or that he's comfortable in.
He's a, he's a Melvin P. Thorpe. He's a hypocrite in a
sense.
He
is. And it's, there's this weird kind of divide between what he, the values he holds up versus the life he actually lives. Mm. I mean, that's, you know, the famous last shot. He, you know, he's brought Debbie back. Everyone goes in the house and he doesn't go in the house. He walks away. There's no place for
him
there.
There's no place for him there.
He doesn't see any place for him mm-hmm. there. And I think that there is something that I don't, that maybe is representative. I don't know. I don't want to put it just on Texas, but like that of this very idea of what's become Americanism, you know, and the like this idea of what it means in maybe even a Fox News sense versus the reality of what America is. I think that there's a very interesting tension there.
It's John Wayne as Ethan Edwards, who had a rare kind of courage. The courage that simply keeps on and on, far beyond all reasonable endurance, never thinking of himself as martyred, never thinking of himself as brave.
So we'll find him in the end, I promise you. We'll find him.
Here is a story of a man, hard and relentless, tender and passionate, of people who dared to challenge a hostile land. Here is drama of great love and aching loneliness.
I found him. I found Lucy.
What you saw was a butt wearing Lucy's dress. I found Lucy back in the canyon.
What was she?
What do you want me to do, draw you a picture? Spell it out! Don't ever ask me. As long as you live, don't ever ask me more.
It's set mostly in West Texas, despite it being filmed in Monument Valley. And it is just a great series of giant frontier shots that are just some of the most memorable shots that I think you can find in just in memory in cinema. And it's just a great Western in general. It's one that if you haven't had a chance to see, it's really worth taking the time to see, especially for its very complicated relationship to the Native American characters, which I think, you know, has been much analyzed over the years, but is it could lead to endless discussion. So that is The Searchers. It is streaming on Amazon.
All right. Well, we had to have a Western. I think we've all, and from my perspective, we also have to have a movie from one of the guys who, to me, just is one of the definitive Texas filmmakers, a more recent one, and that's Richard Linklater, who I certainly associate with Texas, specifically Austin, which I guess is a different sort of Texas. But I guess if you're going to do Richard Linklater and you're going to do Austin, you might as well do the definitive Austin movie, which to me is Slacker from 1991 and is available on Netflix Instant. And what's interesting looking at it again, and I hadn't seen it in quite a few years, is having spent so much time now in Austin covering South by Southwest and covering Fantastic Fest and all these different things is, on the one hand, Austin doesn't look like this anymore. Austin is much more like urban and modern, and there's a lot more kind of going on. It just seems busier. The Austin of Slacker just seems much more Slacker-ish. On the other hand, this is still exactly what Austin is like. That sort of, you know, keep Austin weird vibe. And the fact that, like, anytime I've been to Austin, I've never been in a taxi cab where the driver wasn't listening to, like, conspiracy theory radio. Being an outsider, and I think Slacker is one of the great movies about sort of outsiderdom and just people who don't fit in and have this weird sort of unusual perspective on things. Some of the camera work, some of the sound work, a lot of the acting, they're not exactly what you would, you know, call professional grade. But even despite all that, the structure of it I still find so beguiling. You know, this idea of you open with this guy who's played by Richard Linklater himself. He's arriving in Austin on a bus, and then he takes this cab ride into the city, and on the cab ride, he just talks to the driver nonstop about this dream he's had and his theory of the universe.
Man, there was this book I just read on the bus. Well, you know, it was my dream, so I guess I wrote it or something. But, man, it was bizarre. It was like the premise for this whole book was that every thought you have creates its own reality. You know, it's like every choice or decision you make, the thing you choose not to do fractions off and becomes its own reality, you know, and just goes on from there. Forever. I mean, it's like, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy meets the Scarecrow and they do that little dance at that crossroads and they think about going all those directions, then they end up going in that one direction. I mean, all those other directions, just because they thought about it, became separate realities. I mean, they just went on from there and lived the rest of their life, you know, just, I mean, entirely different movies, but we'll never see it because, you know, we're kind of trapped in this one reality restriction type of thing, you know?
Allison, I could have right now, I could watch Conan the Barbarian or I could watch Conan the Destroyer. Whichever one I pick, there is somewhere an alternate reality where I pick the other, or a third reality where I watch both, because that's probably what I would really do. But once we make a decision, there are all these alternate universes, and the movie itself kind of mirrors that structure where we follow one person to the next, and we follow that Richard Linklater guy to another guy who has this weird voodoo ritual going on in his apartment, to someone who walks past him who's a street performer, to a woman who gives him some money and then goes into a coffee shop, to a guy who's espousing these crazy conspiracy theories. You know, it's almost like a city symphony film that's played entirely by, like, street buskers. You know, it has this wonderful, unusual structure that I every time I watch it, you kind of forget exactly the order and you just kind of love the way you just follow these people. And it really holds up as a really fun film, and still I think a very important film in the history of independent cinema. You know, a real great example of what you can do with basically no money, basically no sets, almost no script. Really, it doesn't really feel like a scripted movie in that sense. So that's Slacker, and it is available on Netflix Instant.
This episode of Film Spotting SVU is also sponsored by MoviePass, a subscription service which allows you to pay a monthly fee and see a movie per day at many major theaters. You check in using an app on your smartphone and you use a membership card. It works for any new release, though it doesn't yet cover 3D or IMAX.
If you're a frequent moviegoer, MoviePass is a service that could make a lot of sense for you. Rather than paying per ticket, you just pay that flat fee for the month, and that will get you an entry to one film per day. I just used my card a few days ago to go see Zero Dark Thirty. To sign up, go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and use the code FILMSPOTTING to get $10 off your first month of subscription.
Well, sir, instead of me kicking this off, maybe this, you could tell us the questions we need to ask.
It's pretty simple. You're going to pay me for a service that I'm going to perform. You're going to give me the particulars of her schedule. Her habits. I'll act on them accordingly. I won't give you many details on my activities because the less you know, the better for everyone involved.
All right.
Now, I only have a couple of rules that I insist on sticking to. Insist.
Okay, yeah.
If you're caught, if you're implicated in this crime, you are not, under any circumstances, to reveal my identity or participation.
Oh. Of course.
If you break this rule, you'll be killed.
Well, now it's time for our listener's choice pick. You guys voted for Killer Joe, directed by William Friedkin, available on iTunes and on VOD. Killer Joe is the second collaboration between director Friedkin and writer Tracy Letts. Their first was the 2006 Ashley Judd, Michael Shannon film Bug, which is very good, very claustrophobic, tale of mutual delusion. It's also pretty disturbing.
Definitely. Just pretty disturbing?
Pretty, very intensely disturbing.
Yes.
Letts is best known for the play August, Osage County, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008. Killer Joe was actually his first play from 1993. The film stars Emile Hirsch as small-time drug dealer Chris, who moves back in with his father Ansel, played by Thomas Hayden Church, his stepmother Sharla, played by Gina Gershon, and his childlike sister Dottie, played by Juno Temple, after getting kicked out by his mother. Maybe a good thing, since he's come up with a plan to kill her for her life insurance policy, which he believes is going to go to Dottie. To get this done, the family makes a plan to hire Joe, played by Matthew McConaughey. He's just your average Dallas detective who moonlights as a contract killer. They can't pay Joe up front, but they promise to pay him out of the money they'll get from the life insurance payout. Normally, he wouldn't agree to a plan like this. He's a professional, but he is smitten with Dottie and takes her on as a retainer while they wait for the payout, which, of course, does not work out smoothly as planned. Now, I was a little ambivalent about this film at the end and curious about other people's take on it because it was a very divisive film. I know there are some people who really liked it. It ended up on some top 10 lists. Mm-hmm. Other people loathed it. Okay. So I thought one interesting read on it was that it was basically your classic noir structure, almost like a Double Indemnity type setup, filtered through these really exaggerated and I don't really know. It's white trash stereotypes, I would say. With McConaughey playing this perfectly gentlemanly Texan psychopath. So Matt, I wanted to know, what did you think about how how heightened these characters are on, particularly Ansel, Charlotte, and Chris, who are really just hot messes. You know, the first time we're introduced to Charlotte, it's by way of her bare crotch.
I like that you ask the question and then just drop bare crotch in there, almost the way the movie drops the bare exactly. crotch in there by introducing the woman, not just bare crotch first, but like from like the chest down. So you can't even really see. I don't think you see her face at first. No. You just see it's just like a face full of crotch. Yeah. Well, they are certainly trashy, and the movie doesn't exactly paint them in the most flattering light. I felt that by the end of the movie, sort of what you were getting was a very cynical portrait, not necessarily of white trash, but of America. There's sort of this very disturbing, very deranged dinner scene at the end of the movie, and it's almost like the craziest nuclear family you've ever seen, you know, where there's like dad is kind of serving everyone and ordering people around the table, and what are they eating? They're eating Kentucky Fried Chicken, and there's side dishes, and everyone's, you know, handing everything out, and because of these really disturbing things that have happened a few minutes earlier, everyone is kind of shell-shocked. And it's just like this, it's like the most horrifying vision of the American family life that you've really ever seen. It's really kind of disturbing and shocking. And so at a certain point, that's what I kind of realized, at least Tracy Letts and William Friedkin were going for. Whether you think they succeeded, that's what I felt they were trying to do, is not so much make a movie about white trash, but make a movie about like sort of the intense sickness of all Americans, that this is almost like the ultimate American family and that we're all kind of disgusting and dumb and fast food laden and prone to despicable acts and cruelty and inhumanity and sexual sadism and all these sorts of things. I'm guessing from the way you suggested in your intro, you're not necessarily buying that though.
I don't know that I don't buy it, but I don't know that I think it's particularly that
successful.
Sharp a point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I think that to just be like, look at how disgusting and squalid and like self-obsessed and, you know, selfish all these people are. I feel like if there you're going for a kind of satire on America in mm-hmm. that larger sense, that I would kind of want it to be a little more exact.
Okay.
I think. And I think that just because particularly the main family are so contemptible, like deliberately made to be very contemptible and just awful. I wasn't really sure if we were just invited, if we were meant to just be invited to just wish the destruction of this, like just to watch these people implode, or if we were, particularly in the character of Dottie, who is the innocent, right, but also kind of like the holy fool. She's sometimes aware of what's going on, and sometimes this thing to be protected.
Yes.
If we were supposed to kind of hope for any,
like her being saved somehow,
yeah,
or rescued,
her being saved, you know. But even then, when people really, the only person who cares about her, who seems to care about her, is Joe, you know, in a weird way, as much as he buys her.
I would say the brother cares about her as well,
but
perhaps for disgusting reasons. There's a very strong suggestion, you know, that he has incestuous feelings for the
right.
sister. But I would say he cares for her to some degree.
I don't think so? Well, I mean, I feel like that was just as much about him. Like, he makes this deal pretty easily, you know, and then kind of comes around to it after messing everything else up. You know, it's more, I think, this idea that he doesn't want after he wants to save his sister from being sullied long after he's like she's been engaged in this relationship.
Yeah, I think it's a little more complicated than that, their relationship. I mean, he seemed to feel guilty.
Yeah.
And it seemed a little more complicated. Does he love his sister? Does he love his sister? Mm-hmm. Does he feel guilty for making this unholy bargain? Does he really care, or is he just, interested in her himself? I thought it was a little bit more complicated than you're giving it credit for.
Well, I will accept that there would be something like that there, but I feel like part of that, the whole fight over her in the end, was just about him, like the fight between him and Joe.
Okay.
As a kind of like pissing contest, right? Like there's literally a scene where they kind of declare like she doesn't get a say in what her destiny is.
Right.
And they're both ordering her to either stay or go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I don't know. Either way, as a hero of sorts, he's a pretty difficult one to kind of reckon with.
Emil Hirsch's character?
Yes.
To a certain degree, isn't this, I also looked at it as this is just, kind of a classic style film noir where just about everyone is venal and awful. You don't really necessarily root for the heroes of most film noirs,
No,
I don't root for Robert Mitchum in Out of the Past.
But
I love that
certain
movie.
He has charisma, right? And likability. Whereas everyone in this is like just kind of a disaster,
You didn't think Matthew McConaughey had charisma?
Oh, I think so too. I think he would have by far the most charisma. I think his is kind of the most interesting performance.
Okay.
But he's like the kind of outside frightening figure, right?
Uh-huh.
Like he's not Robert Mitchum, I don't think.
Well, maybe not. I don't know. I also thought Thomas Hayden Church was strangely kind of compelling and likable in the movie, even though he, again, at the end of the movie does some horrible things, or at least permits horrible things to happen to other characters, and is really just rock stupid. I just thought it was a really kind of, maybe it's just that I like Thomas Hayden Church so much,
yeah,
that I just thought there was just a little bit of humanity, just enough in there to make me like this character despite all the horrible things that he did.
Yeah.
Or at least like his performance and really kind of get a kick out of it. At the very least, I can say that I definitely laughed at his performance on quite a few occasions.
He did get one of the best lines in the movie at one part where Joe asks him, like, what do you think? And he says, I don't. So he's very aware,
yes,
of his place in life and kind of intellectually as well.
Yeah.
I thought most of the performances were pretty strong, even as some of them were kind of shriller than others. But McConaughey was really enjoyable in this as a character who seems to kind of think of himself as following certain codes and having this precision, but who's totally a psychopath as well. Like,
right.
He has this great kind of all black cowboy outfit, and he the times when he chooses to show emotion and when he doesn't at all are seem like all messed up. He has this great moment of joy towards the end that's so weirdly placed just in terms of the timing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like his even his sense of humanity is just like all off in terms of that timing.
Well, having heard you earlier in the episode talk about John Wayne and The Searchers, I thought there was kind of a similar vibe to his character, that idea that he's got this, very refined, principled exterior, and he, as you said, he is a professional, and he takes things very seriously, and he only works in certain ways, and he has a strict rules that he follows, and the way he always wears gloves. He's clearly, like he's thought this all out. On the other hand, he has this incredibly dark side, this very messy side that he can barely keep under control. So I thought that was an interesting sort of, maybe it's not the most original depiction of that sort of Law and Order or cowboy character or whatever you want to say, but I thought it was an effective one. I thought it was a great performance of him by McConaughey, and I thought he fit well within this very bleak kind of worldview. I guess the one character that, to me, I think I enjoyed the movie more than you did. I think, to me, the character that I sort of had the most trouble with was Dottie, was Juno Temple's character, because I didn't understand her, you know? And as you said, there are times when she seems more aware, there are times she seems less aware. And it is made very explicit that this plan to kill the mother, who's never seen, she's not present, the ex-husband, the ex-husband's new wife, the son and the daughter all are plotting to kill the mother. And even Dottie, who's the sweet, innocent girl, is like, when are we going to do it? How are we going to do it? She's on board with the plan. But I wasn't fully. I don't know if it's clear. How old is she supposed to be?
Asks her. She never says.
I thought there was one reference in there somewhere to her being like 12 or 13 years old.
No, she says I'm 12, and he says I'm 12 as well.
Right. So. Yeah, I know, but it's not. But that's what I'm saying. It's not really. But it's not really clear to me how old.
I mean,
she
doesn't go to school, right?
Not that we see.
Not that we see. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that she's supposed to be a like. I don't know, just like an adolescent. I feel like she's supposed to be in her late teens at least, but I don't know. I think if there are issues of kind of consent in that way, there are more issues in that she's presented as maybe not fully mentally developed,
right,
you know,
right.
And that's where that comes in.
I mean, I'm not really like saying I was uncomfortable with that aspect of it per se. I was just more confused. Like I just wanted a little more clarity on exactly who this character is and what she's thinking and where does she come from and how developed mentally is she? Yeah, I just felt like some of that would have made the end of the movie, I think, more interesting when her character kind of has this big moment at the end of the film. I just felt like I would have had a bigger, stronger emotional reaction to it if I had connected with her character in some way. Not necessarily like, oh, I like her more or I dislike that character. I just wanted to understand her a little better. I don't know that the movie really fully makes me understand her.
Yeah, I felt like she was kind of almost like a Flannery O'Connor figure. Like, there's this kind of classic Southern Gothic quality to her, I feel like, as this childlike woman who, you know, is this attractive quantity in that way because she's so unspoiled, but is also this, you know, is vulnerable and is to be protected or maybe just to be bargained off. I thought there was a little bit of that to her, but... Yeah, I feel pretty mixed on this movie. It wasn't one that I enjoyed thoroughly, but I did like McConaughey's performance. I think that maybe I wanted to enjoy it more for its outrageousness, and I didn't really.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. I felt like it was maybe, like it was turned up too loud somehow.
Too over the top? Too shrill?
Yeah. And also I felt like it was inviting too much contempt. For
the characters
on screen, like in a too easy way.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you say that because it did remind me in some ways of, you know, like a Coen Brothers movie, certainly like Blood Simple in some ways. And of course, that's the classic complaint about their movies is that they're, you know, laughing at their characters. They're inviting you to look down on their characters. And it sounds like you sort of felt like this movie, you want to kind of level that criticism against this movie to some degree, right?
Yeah, I felt like it made them such broad targets that... Mm. That was a little too easy a position to take.
I guess we really have to, before we wrap it up, we got to at least discuss the end. I mean, we haven't even talked about, you know, sort of the big, what's the word I want to use, Allison? I don't know. The deeply fried scene? There is a infamous...
spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. There, I won't say what, but there's a scene, the end of the movie involves a sort of disturbing sexual act that involves, in some way, the use of what is called K-Fry C, perhaps to avoid a lawsuit from...
I'm sure Kentucky Fried Chicken did not sign up for product placement.
No,
there.
I don't think they paid for the product placement, although it's an effective one in this case. We haven't... I guess it's interesting that we've gone 15 minutes or so talking about this movie without mentioning the big thing that became sort of a lightning rod to the extent that there was one. Were you offended by it? Were you outraged? What was your reaction to it?
I wasn't offended by it, but I think that it does to go to that, like, if this is like its skewering of like America and particularly this like type of American culture, it's a pretty broad metaphor.
Yeah.
You know? And I think like in terms of like that, any satirical power was a little lost on me because of that. What did you think of it?
It was a little, to me, it was a little much. It was a little over the top for me. I mean,
over the top.
Just a little. Just a tiny bit. I mean, I wasn't really outraged or offended or anything like that. But I didn't exactly feel like I was seeing some brilliant statement either. And I don't know the explicitness, I'm not sure if it really was justified.
Yeah, it does feel like it goes on forever. And that,
so to speak.
So to speak. And it is one of the most indelible images, if not the most indelible image.
Well, that's true.
In the movie.
That is true.
To the point where the poster was of a... like Kentucky Fried State of Texas.
Yeah, it was like a chicken nugget in the shape of the state of Texas.
Yeah, But I don't think it's actually that, I guess it's not that clever an image for me. I don't think that it's actually that resonant an image.
Yeah, and
other
like,
than it's for its shock value.
And as I was saying, I feel like the stuff that happens after it felt to me more smart and more powerful, and I felt like I got the point there more than I did in this sort of very intense sexual scene. Although perhaps the counter argument there would be, well, you wouldn't get that if that scene wasn't so disturbing and intense, then the stuff that happens afterwards wouldn't hit you in quite the same way. And I don't know, maybe they have a point. I guess I thought it was interesting, worth seeing. I did laugh a few times. I think it's got some really nice performances. McConaughey certainly number one, but I thought Thomas Hayden Church was great as well. So I would certainly say it's worth seeing. It certainly, you know, I don't regret not seeing it in time to make my top 10 list or anything like that. It wouldn't
same
have,
here.
Yeah, it wouldn't have made my you know top 10 films of 2012 or anything like that. But I'm glad I saw it. I certainly got some stuff out of it. I'd say it's worth seeing.
Yeah, I don't like it as much as you do, but I would say that if you were to pick between these two, Bug would be the one of the Friedkin-Letts collaborations.
You prefer that
one. I would
one.
Definitely prefer Bug, yeah.
This one, as horrible as that is to say, is probably an easier sit, though, which is so terrifying.
Bug is a little more psychologically fraught, definitely.
Yeah. And I feel like I could almost watch this movie again, whereas you'll never get me to watch Bug again, I don't think. It'd be very, very
which
difficult.
May be an endorsement for some. That's
perhaps,
a
perhaps
strong
it
statement.
Would. Exactly, that's true. It depends on what you're in the mood to see. Well, this is Killer Joe, and it is available now on VOD and iTunes.
Before we move on to Behind the Eight Ball, we have a prize to give away. We have another prize. We know, actually, that we have not yet mailed the prize that we gave away last time we did this, but it will happen. Scout's honor, it will happen. In the meantime, we have a new prize that we're going to give away via the Resurrected Keyword Game, which is something we used to do on the old IFC News podcast. How it works is we pick a film that is related to the topic we talked about today, and we pick out five terms from that film's IMDb keyword page. So they have to do with the film. You have to use those clues to guess which one it is, and then you email us, and we will randomly pick a winner. Matt, do you want to tell us about the prize?
Okay, this week's prize is the new Criterion Blu-ray of Following, Christopher Nolan's first film. This was donated to us to give away as a prize by the lovely people of IFC Films, and it's the brand new Blu-ray edition, Spy number 638. You get a commentary from Christopher Nolan, a new interview, a chronological edit of the film, lots of cool stuff. It is available now if you want to buy a copy, but for one lucky winner, we have one free Blu-ray copy. If you know the movie that belongs to these IMDb plot keywords, Allison.
Small town, racism, based on book, what happened to epilogue, and locker room.
What could it be? What could it be? If you think you know, email us at svu@filmspottingsvu.com. Your entry must be received by Monday, January 21st at noon, and we'll announce the winner on our next episode. Good luck, everyone.
Now it's time for Behind the Eight Ball, in which we give you a rapid-fire countdown of three picks that are new to streaming, two that are expiring soon, and one pick chosen blindly by number from our Netflix queues. Matt, you're up first. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, three new films.
Okay, I'm going to start with Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol from 2012, the latest and perhaps greatest film in the surprisingly long-running and surprisingly high-quality Mission Impossible film series. In Gotakal, as the kids call it, Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt is yet again betrayed and hung out to dry by the rest of the Impossible Mission Force and must save the blah blah from the clutches of the etc. while retrieving the who gives a crap while dangling off the awesomely tall Burj Khalifa in Dubai. Gotakal's awesome creative and financial success gave director Brad Bird a flawless victory in the Mortal Kombat battle for live-action Pixar director supremacy over John Carter's Andrew Stanton. That is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Also available on Netflix, The Untouchables from 1987, directed by Brian De Palma and written by David Mamet, starring Kevin Costner, Robert De Niro, Andy Garcia, and in his Academy Award-winning performance, Sean Connery. It's the story of G-Man Elliot Ness and his attempts to bring down Chicago mob boss Al Capone, and I will suggest this as smart alternative viewing to Gangster Squad. Skip that. See The Untouchables again, or perhaps for the first time. And finally, Everything or Nothing, the untold story of James Bond 007. Speaking of Sean Connery, although he doesn't appear In new interviews, this authorized documentary from the creators of the long-running James Bond spy franchise is, contrary to its title, not quite an exhaustive look at the James Bond mythos. It's not exactly an ultra-fluffy, back-slapping victory lap either, though. At just over 90 minutes, it can't quite be comprehensive, but it does have some interesting commentary from just about every actor but Connery who's played the role, including George Lazenby, on his epically dumb decision to hang up the iconic martini and tuxedo combo after just one film because, as he thought, 007 would not be relevant in the 1970s.
Whoopsie.
So that's Everything or Nothing, available on Netflix.
Okay, two expiring titles.
Expiring on January 24th is the documentary Hell and Back Again, one of the Academy Award nominees for Best Documentary last year, actually. It's a very well-shot film. It follows a U.S. Marine during and after his tour of duty in Afghanistan. If the field of battle in the Middle East sounds intimidating, just wait until you see what it's like to navigate Walmart in a wheelchair on a busy Sunday. That is crazy stuff. So that's Hell and Back Again, expiring on January 24th. Expiring on January 25th is Enter the Void. It's your last chance to find out whether you have epilepsy by subjecting yourself to Gaspar Noé's druggy hyper-psychedelic journey through Tokyo, life, death, and the beyond.
All right, and one from your queue.
You gave me number 99, which in this case is entitled Drag Strip Girl, from 1994. This is actually a TV movie from a very interesting forgotten TV series on Showtime from the mid-90s called Rebel Highway, where they invited these big-name Hollywood directors to remake old exploitation movies from the American International Pictures Studio. So there's episodes, or movies really, that were Runaway Daughters, directed by Joe Dante, Motorcycle Gang by John Milius, Jailbreakers by Killer Joe director William Friedkin. In this case, Drag Strip Girl is directed by Mary Lambert. Our buddy Rob Sweeney found these. I don't know how he found them, but he told me about them a few months ago, so I added all of them to my Netflix instant queue. Allison, are you ready to go behind the eight ball?
I'm ready.
All right, let's start with three new releases.
Okay, my first pick is The Exploding Girl, 2009 indie film that is now on Hulu. It's directed by Bradley Rust Gray, who he and his wife are both filmmakers, and they make very kind of intimately shot portraits of people, generally. Their films can be described as. This is a film starring Zoe Kazan as a young woman who is home in Brooklyn from college for the summer. She has epilepsy, and our awareness of that kind of colors the story, even though most of it is just about how she breaks up with one boyfriend and tentatively starts thinking about a romance with a friend of hers. But it's, as much as it's an imperfect film, it's got a really nice and like very kind of subtle performance from Zoe Kazan, who's really a rising star in the indie film world. It's Exploding Girl. It is on Hulu. Next, My Sucky Teen Romance is now streaming on Netflix. It's the third film from Emily Higgins, who is the ripe age of 20 now. She is known for directing the 2006 independent zombie feature Pathogen at the age of 12. I don't know what you've done with your life at the age of 12. This is a vampire comedy. This is partially funded off of Indiegogo. Had its premiere at South by Southwest. Higgins has been a kind of a standard figure there at Fantastic Fest. And it's kind of amazing just that she's managed to get this done at so early an age, and is kind of, she's kind of expanding her ideas about filmmaking as she gets older. Maybe by the time she's 25, who knows what type of epic film she's going to make. That's My Sucky Teen Romance. It is streaming on Netflix. And last, wanted to get in another Western. Hondo is also streaming on Netflix. Another John Wayne Western, though you won't get to see it in Warner Color 3D. You'll have to deal with standard 2D.
Aw, shucks.
Stars John Wayne as a title character, who in this case is part Apache. And this film has an interesting parallel to The Searchers in terms of its treatment of Native Americans, since the main character is caught between this tribe and the soldiers who are coming in. And it ends with a kind of more mournful sense that the Native American characters are being chased away, their way of life is ending. So that's Hondo. It is streaming on Netflix.
All right, and two expiring titles.
Expiring January 26th from Netflix, Winter's Bone, directed by Deborah Granick, the film that made Jennifer Lawrence a star, and it is really a spectacular breakout role for her now that she's, a big movie star with Oscar prospects yet again. It's a really nicely made Ozark noir that is set in this very close community up in the mountains. It also features a really good turn from John Hawks, but it just is like, in terms of having this really tough female lead character, it's so enjoyable. It's worth checking out if you haven't yet. And expiring February 1st from Crackle is Dragon Wars. If you have a taste for kind of novelty in terms of productions, which I always do, this is a 2007 film that was, at the time, Korea's largest budgeted, despite the fact that it's set in Los Angeles and stars the lead of the WB show Roswell, as well as Robert Forster. Actually, the director Shim Hyung-rae, in the Korean version of the film, had ended it with this message: D-War and I, and that was the title it was released as, D-War and I will succeed in the world market without fail. So this was like a very calculated foray into making an international blockbuster. Did not really make much of a mark. It was not well received, and it is not a particularly good movie, despite very extensive dragon special effects. But it is very odd, and I think in that way, it is worth checking out just in terms of all international funding and an attempt to make a foray into Hollywood filmmaking from Korea. So that's Dragon Wars, expiring from Crackle, February 1st.
All right, and one random film from your queue?
All right, you picked number 38, which is Penny Serenade, 1941 film, starring Irene Dunne and Cary Grant as a love-struck married couple who keep trying to have a child. And then they keep losing the child. There's a pregnancy that doesn't work out, and then they try and adopt, and it's the tearjerker, directed by George Stevens. I have no idea why this is on my queue. I do not know what led me to choose it, but it is there.
It's a classic. You don't. What more reason do you need than that?
I don't know. I don't think Cary it's Grant. One that I would have normally. I love Cary Grant, but Irene I don't know
Dunne.
That seeing a couple. Lose children again and again.
That doesn't
ways.
Sound like a
sounds like something
a fun
that I
Saturday
would,
night
yeah.
for you.
Not necessarily, but so that's my number 38, Penny Serenade. It is on Netflix.
Okay, well, it's time to go through our listeners' choice options for our next episode. And this week, basically, the theme is already chosen, and you're just going to have to decide which of these three movies you want to be the anchor of that theme. You may have heard a few weeks ago, or maybe a month or two now that we're recording this, Netflix signed a new deal with Disney to premiere some of their movies and also to have a lot of their back catalog available on Netflix Instant. So they have already added a bunch of Disney movies, and we thought that might be a good reason to do a Disney-themed SVU podcast. So we've got three different animated Disney films that are all available on Netflix Watch Instantly, and we're going to have you guys choose which of the three is our listener's choice review next time. Allison, what's the first option?
The first option is Dumbo, which is the 1941 film about the elephant with large ears who can fly, of course. This was the fourth animated feature in the Walt Disney Animated Classic series, so it's very early on in this, you know, kind of landmark animated series mm-hmm. of films.
Okay, option number two is Alice in Wonderland from 1951. This is the 13th Walt Disney animated classic, and definitely one of the most famous, one of the most beloved, based on the classic Lewis Carroll novel. Remade many times, remade most recently as a hugely successful live-action film. This specifically, though, is the animated Disney version we're talking about here, not the Tim Burton film. This is the 1951 animated Alice in Wonderland. That's option number two.
And the final option, we wanted to do one that was a little closer to the present day, since
yes.
the brand has changed a lot,
certainly,
has tried to keep
certainly.
Up, has been challenged by Pixar mm-hmm. as well, and other animated computer animation particularly. So we decided to pick Treasure Planet, which is not a film I've seen. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it either, although I've been told by people that have seen it that it's kind of an underrated, you know, like it was not successful. It was a bit of a flop. Definitely did not help the life of 2D animation. But supposedly it's kind of good.
So it's the 43rd animated feature okay. in the Walt Disney Animated Classic series.
Okay.
It was released in 2002 as a sci-fi take on Treasure Island, the
right.
Robert Louis Stevenson book novel. And it uses hand-drawn 2D as well as 3D computer animation. And it was, I think it was one of a few attempts by Disney to appeal to a kind of more male-skewing audience. I think they made a few films where they're trying to figure out the secret of the non-princess adoring crowd. I don't know if they ever really lock that down, but Treasure Planet is our third pick.
Okay, so which of those three Disney movies should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, January 21st at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on our Twitter account, at FilmSpottingSVU, and you'll have all that week to watch the film, and then join us for our conversation, which will be on our next episode on Tuesday, January 29th.
FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the episode. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show at FilmSpottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.